Hi, this is J. Michael Straczynski, and you are listening to the Captain America Comic Book Fans Podcast.
Greetings, Cap fans, and welcome to episode 178 of the Captain America Comic Book Fans Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Verbanis, and as always, I'm joined by the best gosh darn co-host out there. Oh, Bob, we've had plenty of experience with sneak attacks. Pearl Harbor, the terrorist nuking of San Diego, the destruction of our first Mars colony. It's a long and bloody history. Do you know what we learned from it? That the sneak attack is the first resort of a coward. You didn't even have the decency to pick a military target, a poorly armed civilian colony.
I you got me. Could it be from Babylon 5?
Good guess, Bob. Yes, right, that is right, from Babylon 5. It's actually season 1, episode 1.
Wow.
And the name of the episode was Midnight on the Firing Line. That was a quote from Sinclair. And so why am I quoting Babylon 5, Bob?
Well, because tonight we're going to be talking to J. Michael Straczynski, Rick.
Yeah, he's the creator, writer of Babylon 5. And I thought this quote was actually really pertinent to the story he's telling currently in Captain America, right? Is talking about, when you first hear this, sneak attacks in Pearl Harbor, you almost wonder if it's Steve Rogers saying the quote. But then, you know, I think I saw your eyebrow raise a little bit when I said the terrorist nuking of San Diego.
Right.
Yeah.
I take long naps sometimes. So yeah. Sometimes I miss things.
Pretty sure I could have heard of that. And then yeah. I think when I said the Mars colony, that's when you realized it was not current times. But with the current story going on with Captain America, we certainly do have our share of cowards doing sneak attacks and going after civilians. So I thought it was an appropriate quote, considering everything. Bob, how's it going? What you up to?
Well, Rick, I've had a bit of a rough day today, but I saved some money. So, you know, I got really, you know, it just maybe it balances out in the long run. But, you know, today I was out this weekend. I went on a date with my wife, not really a date. She had to return some things to the mall. So I went with her and then we had dinner afterwards. Right. And as we were, you know, walking up to one of the stores to return whatever she had purchased, I decided to pop into Ross, which I don't know if you're familiar with Ross. It's like Marshall's, like TJ Maxx, you know, same idea. So I'm in there and I'm looking around and I'm not looking for anything from it, but I'm looking for stuff for my son because he's, you know, they sometimes have nice clothes in there. And so I see these shorts and they're like NBA shorts for the Chicago Bulls, which, you know, he's been watching the Michael Jordan documentary on Netflix again. And so I'm like, oh, I should get those for him. And I'm like, I don't know. They look kind of big, right? They're men's small. I don't know. I'm not going to get them. So I didn't get them. And then I come home and I just casually mentioned to him. He's like, what? I'm like, I would have loved to have had those. So today I had the occasion to head back to that mall, which I rarely ever go to, but my bank branch is there for my work. So I said, I'm going to pop into Marshall's. So I go over to Marshall's. Guess what? They're gone, right? Because that place, I don't know if you knew this or not, but like when we went on Saturday night, it was like awash with teenagers.
Really?
Yeah, that's the teenage thing now. They know what's going on at TJ Maxx and Marshall's and Ross. And like, yeah, they're like locusts in there, like picking out the good stuff. Like they got Nike sneakers and this and that. Anyway, they're gone. Shorts are gone. So I'm like, oh. But I realized like after I finished the stuff at the bank, there's another Ross down where I live in Naples. So I'm like, I'll stop there on my way to pick them up from basketball practice. So I go in there. Sure enough, they got the shorts. So I'm like super pumped. Two pair. I go up to the cash register.
Wait.
Yeah.
I know you have a thing about buying things in twos. You know, when Casey was on the she mentioned that.
Yeah.
Why in the world are you getting Bobby two pairs of shorts of the same short?
Yeah. Well, in case one's in the wash machine.
You are setting your son up for the same psychosis. He is going to move out of the house and be like, I need two of everything.
Yeah, that's probably true. And he'll always be prepared. So anyway, Rick, I go up to, I think you're pointing out this, so there's a mental flaw of mine. But anyway, I go up, like, I need one more flaw brought to public attention. So I go up to the cash register and I put my stuff on the counter and she looks at me for a second. And then she asks me, excuse me, are you over 55? And I'm looking at her and I'm like, why would you ask me such a thing?
Well, I think it's obvious why she would ask me.
So perhaps, yes. So I have this like dumb look on my face, a different dumb look than I normally have. And she says, I'm asking because on Tuesdays, if you're over 55, you get our over 55 discount. And I'm like, well, how much is the discount? And she's like, it's 10%. And I said, well, in fact, I am over 55. And then I said, give me that. And I stormed out of the store in a huff, you know. But I got 10% off. So, you know,
that's good.
That's like $2. So I was pretty happy about that.
You know what? You swallowed your pride for $2.
I did. I've, yeah.
You are.
I swallowed my pride for less. So.
You're a cheap SOB. I swear. I got to tell you, that reminds me of like, you know, when you turn a certain age and then like the very next day in the mail is, here's your AARP card.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to the club.
Oh, I went out. I went long for that free gift.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
I tossed it.
Did you? I don't remember. What the
they kept sending it. Yeah. Sometimes it's like luggage. It's like whatever. Yeah. They kept hitting me hard. And now they're just kind of backing off. And maybe it's... I'm not going to say how frequent because then people will do the math and figure out how old I am.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. As I told you, I think the last time we talked, I learned, you know, the sex secrets of people over 50.
That's true. Get sleep and drink lots of water.
From my AARP magazine. So, you know, that's what you're missing out on, buddy.
So Bob, I know we haven't gone back to the Apple podcast ratings, but we got a new one.
What?
I know. And yeah, you know, hold on. Before we do that, it is funny to me, Bob. Our rating for this show is we have a 4.5 rating. Now, it used to be a 5.0 rating for the longest time, for years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then we got, I think, 2 1-star ratings. And it just blows my mind because I don't know what I think you're probably students from your class or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, but we did get a new 5-star rating, and this one is from Walter in Tucson. Now that name rings a bell, and it's titled "Lots of Fun," and he writes. So it's been a while, but I felt the need to leave another review of the Captain America Comic Book Fans podcast. Rick and Bob continue to produce fun and informative shows. I look forward for every Wednesday morning because I can listen to the latest episode on my way to work. If you're a Captain America fan, you really need to check out this podcast. Well, thank you, Walter. We appreciate you doing another review for us. And listen, We're not bashful. If you've given us a review before and you want to do it again, we won't say no. We certainly do appreciate it. And if you haven't given us a review yet, please go into Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and give us a rating because it does help for others to find this show.
Yep. It's just like the SATs, Rick. You can take them multiple times.
So, Bob, really excited to talk to our guest today, J. Michael Straczynski, who is the writer for the current Captain America series. And we just finished his first story arc, right, which is issues 1-6. I loved this story, Bob. What did you think? Mm-hmm.
I did as well. I did. Yeah, I found it fascinating. You know how much I love stories that weave, you know, the Marvel universe. And of course, Marvel is the world right outside your window, but he weaves so much actual history. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times for a lot of people, probably unknown history, he weaves it into the story of Steve Rogers in the past and in contemporary times in a way that just is enthralling. And so I thought it was interesting, entertaining, informational, but also thought-provoking, which are all the high points for me in any comic book series. So I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. So many questions I want to get to, not only talking about this series, but I want to talk about the quote, Bob. Want to talk about the
quote? Yes.
Yes. Yes. Plant yourself like a tree by the river of truth. Mm-hmm. No, you move quote. Yeah, we got to get to that, right?
I'm familiar. Yes. Yes. You've had some questions about that over the years.
We have. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get to our guest today. Our guest today, J. Michael Straczynski, is an American television and film screenwriter, producer and director, novelist, and comic book writer. He may be best known as the creator of the sci-fi TV series Babylon 5 and its spinoff Crusade, as well as the series Jeremiah and Sense8. Straczynski has written or co-written such films as Changeling, Ninja Assassin, Underworld Awakening, and World War Z. He has written several novels, including his recent release of The Glass Box. For comics, he had lengthy runs on Amazing Spider-Man, as well as Supreme Power, Fantastic Four, and Thor for Marvel, and Superman, Wonder Woman, and Before Watchmen for DC Comics. Straczynski is the creator and writer of several original comic book series, such as Rising Stars, Midnight Nation, Dream Police, and 10 Grand through Joe's Comics. Cap fans were treated to his version of Steve Rogers in a What If-type miniseries, Bullet Points, in 2007. He took a break from comics for several years, recently returning to Marvel, and launched the current Captain America series in 2023. We are very excited to have J. Michael Straczynski join us today. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and that's all we have time for, turns out.
It does go on for a while, doesn't it? Yeah, and if I even have to mention any of that, then, you know, everybody knows who JMS is.
Mainly law enforcement.
All right, we have to get to that story, Bob. So we obviously want to discuss the current Captain America series. But before we do, we want to talk about your 2007 miniseries Bullet Points with artist Tommy Lee Edwards. And for those not familiar, shame on you. This was a story along the lines of What If, where a single action or non-action could change the timeline. In the case of Bullet Points, it featured the death of Professor Erskine before he could administer the super soldier serum to Steve Rogers. This didn't stop Steve from volunteering for a different experiment, which fused his body with the experimental Iron Man armor. You could have started your story anywhere, Joe. Why did you pick at that point, and why focus on Steve Rogers?
What led to the creation of the story was, very often you see on the news, you know, five people were killed today, or one person was shot, one person was injured. We have, you know, school shootings, and beyond just the horror of the moment, I wanted to focus on, you know, what are the effects of this? What are the effects of violence? What are the effects of gunfire? So I was looking for a story that would basically begin with one gunshot. It's called Bullet Points, not just because we're bullet pointing out the future, but also, you know, what's the point of the bullet? What's the impact of the bullet on someone's life? And how does that ripple out across time and space to other people? And how are they affected by it? So the one case, you know, that I could think of really that, you know, took place in the Marvel Universe that was contention on a bullet was Dr. Erskine. So that seemed like the logical place to begin. And then we start to see over the course of the next several issues how that changed the future, to remind us how precious life is and to show us, you know, the impact of that violence.
You know, in the story, we see people denied their destinies as a result of the consequences of that single bullet. While some heroes are never realized, others find a way, kind of like that Jeff Goldblum character in Jurassic Park, right? Life finds a way. Heroes find a way. And as Rick mentioned, Steve becomes sort of an Iron Man surrogate instead of Captain America. Reed Richards becomes the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. a la Nick Fury. Peter Parker becomes Hulk instead of Spider-Man. Bruce Banner actually becomes Spider-Man, or a Spider-Man-like character. And there's been this long debate in psychology about whether it's the personality or the situation that shapes the person, shapes behavior in the moment, or in the context of leadership, whether leaders are born or whether they're made by their experiences and opportunities. In Bullet Points, we see some heroes become heroes, maybe different heroes, but heroes nonetheless, despite these detours in their destiny. Is there a lesson to be gained here? I mean, do heroes find a way, or is it just the luck of the draw?
Well, this goes to the whole nature versus nurture conversation. I do think that one of the points here in the story is that those who are, I think, inclined toward being heroes or being self-sacrificing will find a way to do so, however the conditions may change around them. So for most of them, they do end up still serving, you know, the commonweal in one way or another. But when one avenue is turned off or unavailable, they found other ways to do it. I'm an optimist. As the evening news mitigates against it, I remain an optimist about the human race. I think that, you know, we are better than we think and nobler than we know. That there are those who profit by making us think that we are mean and venal and useless and discarded and replaceable. I stand four square against it. I think that, you know, there is greatness and there are gemstones amid the gravel. And I wanted to use that book to sort of point to the fact that the human spirit endures.
And while Steve is going through this excruciating and lengthy surgery, we see an excerpt from Dr. Fenwick's book written years later. And the quote is, "The miracle wasn't integrating the Iron Man suit into Private Rogers' body. The miracle was how God managed to fit a heart that big into such a small body," end quote. And when I read this line, Joe, I knew you understood Steve Rogers. Can you talk about why you specifically seem to focus on Steve's heart and his bravery and place such a huge emphasis on this in the story?
Well, on the one hand, it comes out of a generation that was all about those sacrifices. But for me, some of the problems that I have in watching or reading some Cap stories is that they focus on the symbol and the shield, and the man kind of gets short shrift. But I think that it's his heart, and it's people in the movies, they respond to the humor of the character, but also to his heart, to his warmth. There's a reason he's off and ends up, you know, running the operations in the Avengers, because they know there's compassion in there. Fighting is easy, you know, blowing stuff up is easy. Compassion is hard, and he does have that compassion. So for me, that the line about the heart was meant to sum up the fact that this is not just a person with powers, but with great compassion for the human race.
And you nailed it. I mean, you're talking to two huge Steve Rogers fans here, so we loved that part.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. So I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of the Disney Plus What If series, sort of the animated What If. Based on the comic book series of the same name. And I got to tell you, I'm struck by sort of the parallels between the Hydra Stomper. I don't know if you're familiar with that character, Steve Rogers in the Hydra Stomper, and the Steve Rogers in the Iron Man-like suit from Bullet Points. Do you think that it was at all inspired by your work?
It's hard to say. I think that sometimes there are just things in the ether that have to be expressed. I was reading an interview with a poet once who was saying that she was outside gardening and felt a poem coming toward her and had to get back to the house to write it down, because if she didn't get back in time, it would just keep on going and find somebody else to write it down. So mm-hmm. I think that there are just certain things that are in the ether, you know?
That found its way into Bullet Points as well, didn't it? Something along those lines. Oh, no, then the current run. Yeah, I'm sure we'll get to that. I know that sounds familiar. Yeah, that sort of thought process.
Yeah. So another thing I have been wanting to ask you for years is the story you wrote. trust me, the listeners know I've been wanting to ask you this for years, because we talk about this all the time. It's the story you wrote.
Dear listeners, I'm so sorry.
You wrote a story during Civil War that in Amazing Spider-Man. And by the way, I loved, was it 533 or 534 where Cap and Peter Parker first battled, and just how you had Peter just being so devastated that he was disappointing, you know, the man he finally got respect from. And it was wonderfully written. And it was really touching, pulled on a lot of heartstrings. And on this podcast, we've talked about it quite often. We've covered Amazing Spider-Man 536 panel by panel. We had the artist Ron Garney on to discuss his approach to the story. We've had a handful of philosophers on the show who've written books on Steve Rogers. And everyone agrees that the following quote ranks up there among the best Cap speeches of all time. And I'm just going to get to the end of the quote. "It doesn't matter what the press says. It doesn't matter what the politicians or the mob says. Doesn't matter if the whole country decides that something wrong is something right. This nation was founded on one principle above all else, the requirement that we stand up for what we believe, no matter the odds or the consequences. When the mob and the press and the whole world tell you to move, your job is to plant yourself like a tree beside the river of truth and tell the whole world, no, you move." There are a couple of different views on the speech, ranging from Cap is 100% correct and is inspiring and exactly what Peter needed to hear at the moment, to you can replace Cap with any villain and the words work just the same. And we've talked about this with everyone else, but we finally have the author here. What was your goal behind Cap's speech? And what do you say to those who suggest it could be easily manipulated by those with evil or misguided intentions?
Well, anything can be. And you know, what is the other alternative? To not express your point of view, to not stand by your belief system, to give sway to somebody else and hold your opinion to yourself. The villains and the bad guys take that as an excuse to then, on top of that, commit violence, or on top of that, to do bad things. It's about conversation. It's about voting. It is about, you know, stating your position in a clear, concise way that reflects who and what you believe, who you are, what you believe. It's not a license to commit insurrection. It's simply saying you must have principles and you must stand by them and you must express them. That's the end of it. I work in Hollywood where when writers and actors go into meetings with studios and networks, very often the line is, "I want you to know I have standards, I have principles, and if you don't like them, I have others." It's this kind of really very malleable point of view. Now look, this country was founded by, you know, fierce individualists who wanted to have a place where they could express their point of view. That's why this country was founded in the first place, you know? So I don't think that, you know, it is an endorsement of anything, you know, villainous. You can take a plank of wood and hit somebody with it across the head with it, or you can make a building out of it. I mean, you know, it's a blunt instrument. But the core of it is that you as a citizen have an obligation to speak, whether it gets you in trouble or not. You know, in Nazi Germany, we saw what happened when people didn't speak their mind, when they saw what was happening with the Nazis and stayed quiet, you know, and what that turned into. I think as long as we're talking to each other and being upfront about our beliefs and then being able to talk about them and revise your point of view as new information comes along, we're going to be okay. When we stop talking to each other, start yelling at each other, or we hide our points of view, we hide our convictions, that's when we get into trouble.
Has this speech been something that has been brought up to you over, you know, over the years, as because it's up there with some of his greatest speeches of all time, and I'm just curious the reaction that you got after you had done it, or and has it resonated, or has it you know, moved on to something else?
No, I regularly hear about it. I see the memes popping up every so often, and that's what you want. Yeah, as an artist of any form, whether it's a writer, an actor, or a painter, or a sculptor, you want the work to have an effect, an impact on the audience. You want the audience to remember what that is. So I'm very happy with the fact that it is still out there. I've seen people trying to take it and co-opt it to different purposes, and I have had some words for them when that has happened. None of them polite, none of them worth repeating on a podcast. But that's what you want, is you want the work to be remembered.
Now, speaking of Hollywood, in 2016, the Hollywood Reporter writes that you announce you're retiring from writing comics. And you dabbled a little since then, but you finally returned to an ongoing series just last year, 2023, with this new volume of Captain America. So what brought you back to comics, and why, of all characters, Captain America?
Well, just to put this in context for a second, there was a period of time where I was, for all intents and purposes, going blind. It was a combination of early onset cataracts, but more importantly, I think called Fuchs corneal dystrophy. And with those two disorders, if you try and repair one, the other one will go unrepaired and will eventually make you blind. And the Fuchs corneal dystrophy was particularly bad. To work at my computer, I had to have the letters about 2 inches high to be able to read them. And it was causing me to fall further and further behind on comics. And I finally just said, you know, I need to not try and achieve the rigor of a monthly book. I'm going to pull away and get better if I can. I was holding off the surgery, so waiting for a new procedure to come along that would do it without seeking to do both at the same time, essentially. And it was a Dr. Mark Terry in Portland, Oregon, who came up with this, developed a whole new technique for doing both surgeries at the same time. Before I walked in there, I was basically legally blind. And when I walked out, I was 20/20. It was remarkable. Wow.
Yeah.
And so I took some time to catch up on other stuff and got pulled into, you know, some features. But then when Marvel came around and said, would you like to do Cap? I said, absolutely. He's always been a favorite character of mine, which is why I always stuck him into Spider-Man whenever I possibly could. And I felt that it was, you know, a good time to sort of reconsider the character, not in a you know, let me rebuild him to my own personal standards, but to delve deep into who that character is. As much as I love the big toys, you know, the starships, battles, whatever else, I'm a character guy. That's where I live. When I worked on the Thor movie with Marvel, my point of view was Asgard great, battles great, Rainbow Bridge great, CGI great. But end of the day, it has to be about two brothers competing for the father's affection. That's the story. That's the gateway drug to bring in people to get the rest of it. So I felt for a while that Cap's character was kind of flagging a bit, that the stories were sometimes looking at him as just being like, you know, the man out of time in a way that made it kind of corny or too much like grandpa or irrelevant, or how does he fit in with the world? And it was kind of one note. Let me dig into his character a little bit. Let me find out who this guy is beyond that. And so my first thought was, you know, his own past. I mean, look at Peter Parker's past, pickling peppers. too many peas in that sentence. what propelled him really to become who he is when Uncle Ben was slaughtered in front of him, you know, was killed anyway. And that had a profound effect on him. Bruce Wayne, when he was a kid, saw his parents, you know, die. We are formed by the events that happened to us in our younger years. And there really had not been any stories about Steve Rogers much before he became Captain America. We have one story where his mom passes away. We see that. But we really have no sense of why this was the right guy on a character basis to become Captain America. This could have gone to anybody. Why him, and why was this the right guy? And I said to Marvel, look, what I want to do is look at those 4 years, give or take, between when his mom passed away and when he became Captain America, and trying to survive on the streets, very little assistance from anybody, no family, which I think, you know, trying to make rent and trying to survive in the city and trying to get odd jobs. And the gig economy is kind of a thing that we can all relate to right now, as, you know, as far as a lot of people in Gen Z in that vicinity. But more to the point, I said, I want his first exposure to Nazis to come through the American Nazi Party, the Bund, which was very popular in New York at that time. Leading up to a big rally at Madison Square Garden, where they you know, had like 10,000 Nazis showing up. and to be able to use what happened before, to talk about Nazis then, which will allow us to talk about American Nazis now by inference.
Mm-hmm.
And to Marvel's credit, they said, okay, they knew it was kind of a risky thing to do because, you know, Nazis are not known for their sense of humor.
Right.
But they said, you know, go for it. And they gave me the freedom to do that story.
So we have a few questions sent in from our patrons that we'd like to sprinkle into the conversation as we go along, Joe. And the first one I'd like to bring up is from Michael C. Johnson, one of our patrons.
Hi, I was very excited when I saw that you were actually going to be using some of the American Bund ideas from the late 30s. Not a lot of people are really aware that that even happened in the United States. What led you to that specifically? And as you go on in this series, will you go into more of the court cases and so forth that were seen at the time?
He's exactly right. A lot of folks don't know that particular slice of our history. In fact, some people were, when the first issue came out, kind of came after me saying, what's this alternate history you have of Nazis in America? You're trying to make something about, you know, the Republican Party. I said, dudes, no, pick up a book, read a book.
Right. Yeah.
So that was the reason for doing that. And to illustrate again the point of that it's that this kind of nonsense can happen anywhere, and it's happening now as well. What was also fun is, rather than digging into the court cases, because that's kind of a dry area, what's also in the book that's also historically based is that the famous gangster Meyer Lansky was basically doing what we see in the book. He and his guys, you know, would find Nazis alone and beat the shit out of them. They would find trucks where they were transporting goods to rallies and hijack them. He actually even called a judge at one point and said, listen, just so you know, I'm going to be doing this stuff. Leave me alone. And the judge was like, go for it. So bringing Meyer Lansky into this was also historically based. It's we try to forget the things that we do that embarrass us later. The, you know, the 10,000 people who were there in Madison Square Garden when we went into the war, suddenly, oh, I was nowhere near there. I was out getting fruit at the stand or something. You know,
sure.
We didn't know from any of that stuff. Certainly it happened, you know, after the Second World War, is that, you know, everyone in Germany who was a party member suddenly said, oh, no, we were never part of the party. We didn't know.
Yeah.
It's funny. When I read the part when they introduced the mob, right? I immediately go to the period piece that John Byrne did, the Batman Captain America, which had the villains and took place during World War II, and it had Red Skull and it had the Joker. And at one point, the Joker finds out he's working with a Nazi, and he's like, I may be an evil criminal, but I'm not a Nazi. And, you know, and started fighting the Red Skull. But it's true. You look at the gangsters, right? And, you know, the lesser of two evils, one of them at least is a patriot.
Yeah. And, you know, to see Steve dealing with that as well was a central thing I wanted to address. In the last issue number 6, there's a part where Steve is kind of doing a bit of narration in his monologue. And he says, look, the war in Europe, you know, didn't end when we decided to stop fighting Nazis. The war ended when we ran out of Nazis to fight. They ran off the battlefield, they took the uniforms off, they split. And if there's anybody who wants to step back onto that battlefield, put those uniforms back on again, now we're in the future, I'll be waiting for them.
Yeah, strong. It was a very strong way to end the story arc. I just actually read number 6 tonight. It was excellent.
What'd you think?
My number one favorite fictional character of all time is Steve Rogers. And so when a writer can get Steve Rogers, you already won me over, right? So But then with your ability to craft the story going back and forth, you know, I mean, you picked a time period of Steve Rogers, you know, between he's 14 and 18, right? Like, you know, as you mentioned earlier in this discussion, you know, people are impressionable, you know, during those time periods. And he's becoming, you know, a man, you know, without any parenting at this point. So I loved it all. I loved the way you weaved it going back and forth between the two. And actually, that brings us to another question from one of our listeners here.
Hi, JMS. Mark Dohmeyer here. Excited to have you on Captain America. Loving the work so far. I'm curious, with a flashback type story as you're doing in this opening arc, when you plot things out, do you have the story idea for the past, the story idea for the present? Do one at a time? Are you plotting them side by side so you can interact them? Or do you do one first, then the other, and then figure out how they can fit together? Keep up the great work.
Yeah, for me, I tend to write, you know, beginning to end. I don't sort of do one piece here, one piece there. I kind of have to go, you know, in a linear fashion. And by writing them both at the same time, it lets me do counterpoint. Whereas you're seeing something in the present, which you can then mirror in the past and vice versa, whether that's visually or thematically. So I tend to write both at the same time and just straight through. And the course of fun of it was taking, you know, the Nazi rally against a peace rally later on. And the methods really haven't changed. It's the story stuff. And to be able to see Steve now, as strong as he is, and then see in the last issue, young Steve, who has been, you know, harassing the Nazis and heckling them, which is all you can do when you're a kid. But he did it. He stood up. You know, even when he was going to be booted out and had things thrown at him, and he still, you know, he did whatever you could do, which is really the key of it. You know, whatever you can do to oppose this kind of thing, however small it is, it makes a difference. That's for intention of Meyer Lansky. And so you see Steve, you know, beating this bad guy in the last issue, and the young Steve, who just managed to save these 10,000 people from being killed, even more sick than he was when he went into this. He may have only 2 years left to live. And even the doctor's basically saying, you know, you're kind of done. And then you go to the black panel of, you know, Dr. Erskine introducing himself. And see how it all kind of pulls together. It's really kind of a tapestry thing.
So, you know, I mean, it's really fascinating because you are interweaving reality or real history with Marvel history. And you've got all these different characters. You've got real world characters. You've got the Bund. You've got the Madison Square Garden event in 1939. You've got Meyer Lansky. And then on the other side, you've got all the panoply of Marvel characters, legacy characters. I mean, there's so much going on here in stories. So Grant Ball wants to know, what sort of preparation did you undertake to understand the characters and their applicable backstories?
Fortunately, I'm kind of a history nut. So I was already aware of like 90% of this stuff. Mm. And the thing you have to bear in mind too is that what separates the Marvel Universe from everybody else is that it takes place in the real world. It's not, you know, Star City, it's you know, New York, it's Manhattan, it's, you know, real locations and real history. So that tradition's already there. And just, again, knowing the background to begin with helped a lot. And also looking back to the past of the character, when the first Captain America issue was written, we were not at war at that time with Germany. But Joe Simon and Stan and others saw what was going on, not just overseas, but also in New York. Again, it was happening right there in front of them. There were regular marches of Nazis down streets in New York and New Jersey. They saw it. They said, we need, as we talked about earlier with Cap's line about, you know, standing up, we need to speak out. We need to speak our conscience about this. And so they did that first issue. And I remember that when it was starting to come out, they were getting threats from the Nazis and were getting harassed. They had to hire security, you know, and had more cops around. So there's a fine tradition in this book of doing this sort of thing.
We had the previous series writers on the show a few times, Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly. They wrote the Sentinel of Liberty series. And by the way, they are huge Babylon 5 fans, big fans of your work. They introduced Steve renting his childhood apartment, and they were absolutely thrilled that you kept that part of their run in your story, with having Steve purchase the building. What was it about that that appealed to you?
I wanted to keep him in the building, and I wanted to show him trying to keep and form a community. That building isn't just where, you know, his mom and lived. He lived is where he has friends and neighbors. And I thought, and this is the one thing I thought would not be controversial. I figured the Nazi run could be, you know, controversial, but the building is about to be sold off and trashed, and kicked out into the street. So wouldn't it be a nice thing to do to show him getting a loan from the Avengers to buy the building to save his neighbors and his friends, fix up the building, and give me something for him to do in the present that was not about big wars or about, you know, fighting Hydra, but it's about looking after people on his own block. And the remarkable thing is, when I did that, I got pilloried on both sides politically, because there were those who said, you know, oh, Joe's endorsing capitalism and he's making Steve a landlord and exploiting the middle class. He should make them all live free. And the other side, when they saw the rent control sign in front, went out of their Mesopotamian minds. Joe is this liberal, you know, anti-capitalistic kind of guy. I guess if you offend both sides, you're doing it right. You know, of all things, I thought that would cause me trouble. That was not on my radar at all. But also in the process of that, let him talk to the neighbors, just hang out with them. This goes back to why I put Asgard in Oklahoma with Thor. Putting Thor next to Iron Man, the power difference is not that significant to look at. But Thor in a small town in the Midwest, suddenly, you know, you have that difference in power, but also it humanizes him more, you know, having to, you know, interact with ordinary people. So having, you know, Steve interacting with just ordinary folks, not just the Avengers, not Spider-Man, but also just you know, his neighbors, again, humanizes the characters. And my job going into this was to humanize and bring out so the better qualities and the nicer qualities and the more humane qualities of Steve Rogers.
So one of the most interesting subtexts of the first story arc of your current writing on Cap involves the recognition that Asmodee, this fallen angel that I think you brought into the Marvel world back in 2007, anyway, that he acts, that he recognizes that acts by individuals can have profound political, economic, cultural consequences in the real world, both directly and indirectly by inspiring others. Who might then pick up that mantle and carry it forward. So in this arc, he's effectively trying to prevent this by assassinating those who might be destined to have a positive impact in the world. And this is how you bring about the collapse of humanity, human civilization. So it's a similar theme that sort of found its way in bullet points as well, that a single variable, an individual, a bullet, the consequences of a bullet can have profound impacts that ripple outward, altering destinies as it continues to ripple. Is this a theme that is of like particular interest to you? And if so, why?
You'll see that theme ripple through a lot of my work over the years, because we are taught, you know, constantly that you can't fight City Hall. One person can't make a difference. The individual, you know, does not move society. So I said, well, you know, the large groups cause social change. That's correct, but it tends to start with one person who can articulate the issue well enough for folks to get behind him or her. And so I figured to counteract that notion that the individual has no value, it'd be nice to have some stories that say the opposite, that there is value to the human being singular, that you can make it, you can fight City Hall, and you can win. You know, every time you say no, every time you know, that you are put in the box and they want you to surrender and you fight back, you know, you won. so much of human history is turned on the individual. So I wanted to sort of, you know, get that across and to say that, you know, to readers, you are not powerless. You are not helpless. You have the opportunity to have great impact if you choose to do so. Yeah, I come from nothing background. I grew up poor. We lived in homeless shelters. We, you know, food kitchens. We moved every 6 months. We were desperately poor. And everyone assumed that I was going to be just, you know, a street rat. Whenever I said I was going to be a writer, they would just laugh. Teachers, you know, they never believed it. But despite everyone around me saying that this kid's a dead end, I kept going. And the work that I've done, I believe, I hope, I think, has had an impact, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's on thousands of people from Babylon 5. I still get emails from people. And one fellow sent me a note saying that he said, my daughter was born with troubles. It was hard to get her to sit still. But for whatever reason, when Babylon 5 was on, she would sit still and she'd watch the show. And I would put her in my lap and we'd watch the show together. And just for that 1 hour, I could just be a dad. And he said, I'm writing this because I want you to know she passed away recently. And when my wife's upstairs asleep, I'll come downstairs and I'll put on a Babylon 5 episode.
Oh my.
And I'll put a pillow in my lap.
Hmm.
I remember just being a dad. If that was all I ever did, it was worth it.
Yeah.
You know? But there are more stories beyond that. Art is transformational. Art has the potential to change things. Individual has the potential to change things through art. I have a project I think will go into production as a feature film in Berlin later this year. I'm fingers crossed. And for part of that research, I talked to a guy who was the grandson of one of the architects of the camps, concentration camps, physical architect. And he said there were two primary rules to be followed in the construction of the camps. Rule one was that when you walked outside the barracks, there was nowhere you could go where you couldn't be seen by guards, either with the tower or on the ground. He said rule number two was even more important than rule number one in some ways, which was that there could not be beauty anywhere. Because beauty leads to hope, hope leads to insurrection. Where you can create beauty, where you can create hope, where you can create optimism, where you can see that the human species is not as mean and vile as some would have us believe, you can affect great change. And that happens on an individual basis.
Well, there's no doubt that your stories have really inspired many people. And thank you for sharing that story about Babylon 5. When you were struggling, when you were young and going through tough times, what inspired you?
Terror, the desire not to die obscure. But beyond that, it was people like Harlan Ellison, for whom I am not the executive of his estate, of all things. Because Harlan was also a street rat who was also discounted at an early age. He was a great role model for me. Rod Serling was a great role model for me. My teachers in high school became, you know, very important to me. A large part of the inspiration that was there was just, I was born telling stories. I've always wanted to tell stories. And from like age four on, I began preparing for that. So my first 3 years were wasted. and just constantly preparing for it. And then when I hit 17, I felt, okay, now I'm ready. And started writing like that day. And began selling articles and short stories and plays and that kind of thing. And I've been writing nonstop ever since then. Anywhere from 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day since I was 17. The machine has never shut down. So it's not that, you know, I needed inspiration. I just, you know, look for a way to shut it off sometimes. Stephen King once said that if you write For fame, you're a monkey. If you write for the money, you're a monkey. If you write even because you love writing, you're still a monkey. You're right because to not write is suicide. And that's where I land.
All right.
I love that quote. Mm-hmm. And speaking of your writing and your stories, like just bringing it back to Cap, one of the reoccurring elements in the story is about time and how it flows and repeats itself. Steve even comments on how what has happened in the past feels like he's reliving it. And then in this issue six, he references mom saying, mom used to say, what goes around comes around. Was this your subtle way, or maybe not so subtle way, of providing commentary on today's issues and about repeating the past?
To a certain extent, yeah, that we are, but also that history is kind of cyclical, that every time we think we've beaten the beast and that particular form of hatred is not going to come back at us again, suddenly it rears its ugly head again, one form or another. And having come out of that generation and now seeing where he is now, he is aware of those patterns, aware of those changes, aware of those cycles. And we must remain ever vigilant against those who would use their power for purposes of oppression and fascism. And it requires a little civic thinking every day.
So Joshua Van Dyne, another one of our patrons, had a question about issue number four. And in that that particular issue, Asmodee meets with a Nazi and seems to reveal that he's somehow responsible for Hitler's plan for a thousand-year Reich. So Joshua wants to know if Asmodee actually met Hitler and put him up to his plan for world domination, or is he just some unseen power pulling strings behind the scenes?
No, that's being taken a little bit too literally. It was more metaphorical than that. It's the general influence of evil more than anything else. It wasn't a personal meeting. They didn't have tea or like a double date or something. Yeah.
Well, and listen, I love this next question because when we had Alana Smith on the show and she was talking about you coming on, she mentioned that one of the things that interests her is that you were talking about having, Steve have a sense of humor. And then obviously talking with you on today's show, we see where that comes from. Matthew Glover asks, I have also really loved your work on Captain America. One of the things that stands out to me is the humor. I have laughed out loud several times while reading your work. My question is this. Is it hard to write comedy with Captain America? How is his humor different from other characters you have written?
I think that's the fastest way to get an audience or readership on board with the character is to make them laugh. Certainly, if you look at the MCU movies, Steve gets some good lines in from time to time. And there's no reason, again, to make him stodgy or grandfatherly. It's, give him some life, some vitality, some humor. And his sense of humor is almost kind of reflective. It isn't tell a joke, say it comments on things in ways that are kind of wry or self-aware of themselves. I didn't want to give him like the Peter Parker sense of humor, which is like, funny quips and that kind of thing. So it's a tad more dry, but no less incisive.
So we have one last patron question, this one from Ash Hitt. And she wants to know, who is your favorite Captain America villain? And would you ever want to write that character into your run?
Golly gosh. That would require some serious, there's so many good options on that. I wish I had a good answer for it because I didn't know that was going to be a dog ate my homework. I wasn't prepared for this. I like all of them. It's hard to pull out anyone. I would love to see a prolonged story where Cap and Dr. Doom just go at it. That could just be a ton of fun. I do have them sort of interacting in the Spidey run for a little bit, mm-hmm. Which was also a fun book to write. But as far as his main cadre of villains, there's too many good choices.
Yeah.
All right. Well, some of our listeners are old school And they stopped reading new comics a long time ago. What do you say to those Cap fans to get them to try out your series?
Well, it would depend on why they stopped reading it. I would think that to a lot of the old guard Cap fans, I think that they may have not found in the book what they were looking for. The humanity of the character. I'm not saying there is or isn't. I'm just saying that may be their perspective on it. What I can say to them is that the book is fun. The book is trying new things. We're taking some new directions on things. And the next arc is runs a lot into the mutant storyline, but I wanted to take a very different approach to it.
Hmm.
So often we see in the mutant world at Marvel, everyone's like taking sides in the wars that are all going on, which is fine. That's perfectly reasonable and fair, but not every story has to be about the war. Some can be informed by the war. You look at Casablanca. It's a movie set against the war, but it's not actually about the war per se. Cabaret, was set against the rising of the Reich, but it's not about the Reich. And I said to Marvel, let me try something a little bit different. I want to vary my writing style a little bit. I have various voices I can pull out when I need to do different things. Something a little more surrealistic, a little more scary for me as a writer. Predict my thought about the cabaret of it all. And so let me take a different approach to looking at the mutant story from those who are affected by it, affected by the war, but are not fighting the war. We're just trying to live their lives and create some characters that you might find interesting. And they said, sure. So the issues 7 and 8 are it's a two-parter where I put myself kind of on the firing line in terms of changing up the writing style. I mean, Cap is still Cap. But mm-hmm. there's ways of surrounding that with an approach you really haven't seen before. So what you're to the old fans, old guard fans, here's a chance to watch a guy in a high wire with no net, taking some huge chances and swinging for the fences. And if that's of interest, then you're welcome to, come along on the ride.
Well, I can tell just from everybody who's listening, if you haven't picked up this series yet, you're doing yourself a disservice because JMS totally gets Steve Rogers as a character, and it's great seeing the hero before he was a hero, and then also seeing him go up against a villain in modern time that is a little out of his comfort zone, right? It's not somebody you go up and you solve with your fist. So overall, just great story, and the art's beautiful as well.
So I'm a big fan of the 12, Joe. It's the 12 issue miniseries you wrote for Marvel in 2008 to 2012. And for those who may not have read it yet, and I encourage you to do so. And if Netflix is listening, make a great series, because I think it's just an amazing story with amazing characters and amazing lessons to learn. But basically, it's about 12 golden age superheroes who get trapped by the Nazis, and then they're put into suspended animation during the closing days of World War II. But they're forgotten about when the Nazis lose and the building collapses, and they're not discovered again until the modern age, when the U.S. government discovers them. And this occurs in the wake of the Superhero Registration Act. And so the government being the government, they try to take these heroes who are now in the modern age and put them to work for the US government, doing superhero stuff once again. And it doesn't really have a lot of Cap stuff in it, although we do see Cap and Bucky illustrated in the closing days of World War II. And we do see a Daily Bugle newspaper that shows when Cap is awakened. And so the other heroes are aware of what's going on. But the idea of Steve Rogers being a man out of time was particularly prevalent in the comics in the 1960s and early 70s. One could say it was almost overwrought in the comics. It was always in every story, an issue that was tackled, this man out of time complex. And so now we see 12 other heroes that are experience a similar sort of man out of time, or women out of time in the case of the Black Widow, except it's a much bigger period of time that they were under suspended animation. So I'm really curious, what inspired you to write this story? Number one, about this out of time experience for these heroes. And number two is you used actual obscure, timely, golden age superheroes that were very two dimensional in the comics. And you gave them amazing backstories and amazing current day stories as well. So the second part of that question is, was it a little bit scary to now start to add all this flesh onto the bones of canon for these characters?
Well, you have to go where the scary stuff happens. You know, that's where the good stuff takes place, you know? I told Marvel, I want to do this book with 12 characters that no one's heard about. And it'll become like a really important book. And they looked at me like I had two heads and feathers. Which I do sometimes, by the way, just for the record. And I wanted to take another look at the whole man out of time thing. And it's also kind of weird sometimes to refer to Steve that way, because how long has he been in this current generation? He's been here for a while now. And he's a smart fellow, and he would have adapted by now for the most part. His values are still his values. They haven't changed, but so is his capacity to, you know, function in the world. It's not compromised by that. And actually, you know, we are all people out of time. The world you live in right now doesn't look like the world you lived in when you were a kid. The world that I live in now has very little bearing on the one I was around when I was a kid. The world changes, and we adapt to it. That's what makes the human race so extraordinary. An animal will just keep doing the same behavior over and over again. But humans, you know, we look at what's happening around us and we adapt, we adjust. But for the 12, what I wanted to do with that was their transition to the current age was sudden. And they are still in the midst of it. And how do we use that to play with issues of racism, issues of culture? The big, you know, dare was, I'm going to give you a background for all these, you know, 12 characters, some of whom look ridiculous, that will make you want to cry. You know, I mean, the dumbest name characters like Rockman, right. And I said, I will make you cry. I will sit down and I will make you cry for that character.
You did. I admit it.
And that's the fun. I love challenging myself. I love, you know, again, being back on the high wire, and everything about that book was up on the wire, but it let me explore, you know, consequences of what happened when we come back and, you know, your family's all passed away. How do you reconcile that? If there's, you know, a grandson now who hates you, there's cultural changes that you can't accept necessarily from where you come from. I like, you know, taking individual stories and using that to go macro on social issues, on personal issues, on the world, on purpose. So it was, you know, again, Marvel, just the good thing about Marvel is that no matter how wacky the idea is that I come at them with, I want to see one bullet change in the world. I want to see these 12 characters no one's heard of before ever make into a book. I want to show, you know, Steve Rogers going, you know, as a 14-year-old tackling Nazis. They let me do it. And that's much to be commended upon, particularly in a time when I think there's a certain overabundance of caution out there.
Besides Captain America, I know you're extremely busy, busy man. So what else is keeping you busy in 2024? Is there any projects or anything coming up that you can share with the listeners?
Golly gosh. Well, I'm trying to remember all of them. One is, again, hopefully I have a film going into production in Germany later on this summer. I just recently did two audio drama things for Penguin Random House. They wanted to go beyond doing just audio books into audio dramas. So I wrote two things for them. One was a big, several hour long thing called Earthlight, which will be coming out in June or July. We're doing the remix now on the audio. Second is an anthology show called The Far Horizon. There's Cap. There's a secret project I did for Marvel, 6 issues. I can't say much about it until they announce it, but there's a really good Cap and Thor story in there.
Oh, cool.
That is exciting.
Yeah, it's one of the most demented things I've ever done for, for comics, which is saying a lot. That's going on. I'm writing in my next novel at the moment. Got some pilots out. I'm also running the Harlan Ellison Estate and the Harlan and Susan Ellison Foundation. So we have, I edited Harlan Ellison's Greatest Hits, which is coming out on March 26th, the same time that the relaunch of the Dangerous Visions books is coming out. So the first Dangerous Visions comes out the same day as his Greatest Hits. Then in June, again, Dangerous Visions comes out. And then the last Dangerous Visions comes out in September, which I mentioned assembled from Harlan's, you know, stories and works and add some new voices to. That book has been 50 years in the making.
Oh, wow.
And we're finally going to finish up that trilogy. I'm also in the process of turning this house into a museum library and getting historical landmark status for it. It's the most remarkable place you've ever seen. It's got towers. It's got hidden rooms. It's got gargoyles patterned after the Watergate characters.
How can someone see this?
Well, people drive by, they can see it. But what we want to do is we're doing some repairs to it, fixing it up, trying some black mold we have to take care of. Toward the latter part of this year, I want to be in having some small tour groups coming through to experience the house and all its glory and all its eccentricity. It has 250,000 books inside of it.
Wow.
By actual count. Just to show you a creative space for a mind that was like no other.
Wow.
And for listeners who want to stay up on the latest, where should they go? Should they go to your website, jmsnews.com, or go on Facebook, which is Hang with JMS? Where's the best way for them to get new information?
JMS News is nothing to do with me directly. It is an archive of my posts over the years. Something like 60,000 posts that I've made over the decades, and apparently I talk too much.
Apparently you do like to write.
Yeah. But the best place for the time being is Twitter. I'm on Twitter just under my last name.
Okay.
And that's where I tend to break the news first. And I do have a Patreon as well, because the writing life is very uncertain. So who wants to go where they be supportive? It's, you know, Synthetic Worlds, or just under my name, either way.
Okay.
Yeah, there's always a lot going on. The weird thing is that I by all rights, I should be hardcore unemployable by this point. But despite that, every year I end up more busy than the year before, and I have no explanation for this.
We're thrilled that you're on Captain America. We hope that you stay on there for quite some time. And so thank you so much, JMS, for coming on the show and wrapping Cap with us.
My pleasure. Stay out of trouble.
Oh, boy, Bob, got to tell you, that was a real fun conversation with JMS. I'm excited to pick up issue 7, which comes out this week.
I am, too. He's really kind of got me on pins and needles, wondering what it could possibly be up on the high wire. Love that. What does that mean, right?
I don't know. And I highly encourage, not only to pick up issue 7 that comes out this week, but also the solicitation for the first collection of 1 through 6. So if you haven't read that, you can go ahead to your local comic shop and tell them that, you know, please order this for you. Or if you're, you know, I think there's some people out there that like to get the floppies, and then they also like to have the collection up on their bookshelf. So that way they don't touch their floppies and they're staying in pristine condition.
Do not touch your floppy. That's what I tell my son all the time.
But yeah, by all means, make sure you pre-order that now. What stood out to you from this conversation?
I just love, first of all, his commitment to the craft, but also, I mean, he's just a thoughtful guy. I love having conversations with somebody who just like gives just an honest, really thoughtful answer to a question where like it's not canned. It's coming from the heart. And it's just authentic. And I love that about Joe. Is just he's just authentic.
Yeah.
And it comes through in his writing, of course, but it's just great to hear it from the man himself.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, he is positive. You know, he is optimistic. He is glass half full kind of guy. And he is trying to write stories about hope. And he's trying to write stories that encourage people to think for themselves and to realize that their voice matters and that the individual matters and look at the, if you don't do something, what the effects could be. And that resonates through a lot of the different stories that he does. So I love that too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to take away from that. And it's really timely because I, even today on Facebook, I was having conversations with some folks about, you know, about this, that question, are we hopeful? Do we have any right to be hopeful? And Joe tells us exactly why we have every right to be hopeful, but also why we should be hopeful.
Yeah. Yep. 100%. All right. So next episode, we're going back to our long tail story from 1990, which is the Mark Gruenwald, Ron Lim story, Streets of Poison. And we're going to be covering Captain America 374, which is part 3 of this 7-part story. And if you haven't read the other parts, make sure you listen to episode 170 and 175 before you come to this one, because that will cover parts 1 and parts 2 for you. So a lot of fun covering that story.
Awesome. I can't wait. There's so much to be looking forward to on this show.
Absolutely. All right, Bob. As always, it's been fun wrapping Cap with you.
It has. Can't wait till next week.
All right. He's Bob Lucius. I'm Rick Verbanis. And you've been listening to another episode of the Captain America Comic Book Fans Podcast.